From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, theater and life in the new South Africa. We meet South Africa's best-known playwright, Ethel Fugard. His first post-apartheid play will have its American premiere next week. His earlier plays about the emotional and psychological consequences of apartheid include The Blood Knot, Sizwe Bonzwe is Dead, and Master Harold and the Boys. Also today, Jimmy Tingle's Uncommon Sense. We talk with comic Jimmy Tingle about religion, politics, drinking, and not drinking, the subjects of his one-man show. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the season openers of Prime Suspect and Homicide. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton says he expects Congress to support his plan to send U.S. troops to Bosnia as part of a possible NATO peacekeeping force, despite the serious reservations expressed by many lawmakers. And even without that support, Mr. Clinton says he will press ahead with deployment. The president said U.S. troops should not have to be in Bosnia for more than a year. U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke has come out of a meeting with Croatian President Tudjman saying he has assurances that Croatia is not about to attack its last remaining Serb-held enclave. Holbrooke was speaking in Zagreb, and that's where Richard Carruthers filed this report.
Holbrooke wanted assurances that renewed fighting in Croatia was not about to wreck his peace talks, which are scheduled in the U.S. at the end of the month. President Tudjman promised him that the Croatian army will not attack the Serbs who control eastern Slavonia, at least not for the time being. Tudjman has only ruled out military action while a peace dialogue is underway. However, talks scheduled this week were cancelled because the Serbs wanted to meet on neutral land, while the Croats insisted they must negotiate on sovereign Croatian territory. Croatian leaders know that Serbs in eastern Slavonia may not be defeated in the manner that other rebel Croatian Serbs have recently been vanquished. And any attack in this region risks intervention by neighboring Serbia and the Yugoslav army. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The president said today he's proud of his 1993 budget, and he did not mean to impugn Democrats who voted for the measure when he said he regretted the tax increase included in the legislation. But UPI's Pi Chamberlain reports congressional Republicans are gleeful about the president's statement.
Republicans criticized the president for having raised taxes by about $250 billion, but Senate Republican Leader Dole, who is trying to take the president's job, said he thought some good might come from the president's statement that the increase was too large.
Now that he is feeling in the mood to say that he's made mistakes, and we all make mistakes from time to time, that we'd be happy to have him join us in this budget debate. In balancing the budget by the year 2002.
The president's remarks did not sit well with many of the Democrats who voted for the tax hike and say now they feel abandoned. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Scientists with a stake in the next space shuttle mission are getting antsy about the launch of Columbia. The mission has now been delayed 6 times, and researchers say that they're running out of perishable material needed for planned tests during the mission. The next launch try is tomorrow, but the weather conditions look iffy. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 13.7 points at 4791.25. Trading is heavy at this hour. 324 million shares have changed hands. This is NPR News. The Senate Finance Committee is working through a thicket of amendments to the GOP tax cut bill. A final vote is expected later today. At about the same time, the House is voting on the Republican plan to slash the increase in spending on Medicare. Democrats say the juxtaposition is telling. Pennsylvania Congressman Ron Klink said the timing demonstrates that Republicans want to squeeze Medicare in order to bankroll a tax giveaway for the rich. Republicans are calling such charges absurd. The Food and Drug Administration is debating whether to allow medical companies more freedom in advertising prescription drugs. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Manufacturers spend millions of dollars each year on ads for prescription drugs, and analysts say if the FDA relaxes current regulations, consumers could be bombarded with $1 billion in advertising. Drug makers say the ads give consumers vital health information, but critics contend the ads can be so dangerous the government should ban them. Dr. Sidney Wolf of the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen is calling on the FDA to place a moratorium on drug ads until it comes up with stricter regulations. Wolf cites a 1994 study that found that half the drug ads directed at doctors contain inaccurate information, and he says there's no reason to believe ads for consumers are better. The FDA is holding public hearings to gather advice on what to do about the issue. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Israel has announced it will allow U.S. drug makers to test new drugs on Israeli patients. Israel's health minister says the new arrangement should cut the cost of producing new drugs. The trial of former Ohio Congressman Donald Lukens has ended with a hung jury. The jurors had earlier found Lukens innocent of three bribery charges, but they deadlocked on the biggest bribery count and on a count of conspiracy. Prosecutors say they'll seek a new trial. Lukens was accused of accepting $15,000 from two businessmen while he was a congressman and then contacting a federal agency on their behalf. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ethel Fugard, is South Africa's best-known playwright. His first post-apartheid play is about to have its American premiere. Fugard is white. His earlier plays were about the emotional and psychological consequences of apartheid. In 1961, when he co-starred in a production of his play The Blood Knot with Zakes Mokai, they became the first black and white actors in South African history to share a stage. Fugard's reputation for defiance spread, and in 1967, the government revoked his passport, which it restored 4 years later. Fugard's plays include Sizwe Banzwe is Dead, A Lesson from Aloes, and Master Harold and the Boys. His new play, Valley Song, opens at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, October 27th. I asked Ethel Fugard how Valley Song relates to the new South Africa.
How does it relate to the new South Africa? Well, I suppose in a sense it tries to articulate or capture this very, very pivotal moment in our country's history, where in a sense a new life is standing on the threshold of all sorts of challenges and has to take a step into an uncertain future, and where an old world, an old life is passing. And I think that metaphor, although it is couched in very, very personal terms in my play, because in essence the play is a personal story, a very human story, I think that is the essential metaphor, the essential political metaphor in the piece.
Now, you play two roles.
Correct.
In the play, what are they?
I play myself. It's... first time I've ever done that is actually walk out onto a stage and confront an audience as Ethel Fugard. And believe me, it was infinitely more terrifying when the moment came than anything I'd anticipated. And then at the heart of the story, well, not at the heart of it, the story of the play as such is about a grandfather and a granddaughter. There's no grandmother and there are no parents to the girl. They're all dead. It's the relationship between a grandfather and a granddaughter. In terms of South African racial categories, coloured, meaning of mixed racial descent. And I play the grandfather as well. So I move between Ethel Fugard, white man, to his name is Abram Yonkers, coloured man.
Now, why did you cast yourself a white man as a coloured man?
That's a very deliberate... device I'm exploiting or exploring in this play, and for very specific reasons. I wanted to capture a degree of ambiguity in passing between those two roles, because I almost see the two roles as reverse sides of the same coin, as it were. And I wanted, you know, because obviously the first audience I had in mind for this play was South Africans, fellow South Africans. I wanted to make, and I think I succeeded on the basis of the experience I had in the country, make a certain political point in sort of blurring the lines almost, as it were, between two individuals of different racial origins.
Did you use makeup or anything? Or did
no,
you appear
no,
on
nothing
stage
at all.
As a white man?
I just turn around and walk into the other role, or leave one role and come back to myself. There's a certain things I can exploit to point that distinction. There's a question of accent to begin with. The coloured man would speak in a very, you speak English in a very different way to the way that I do as a white South African. And he's a much older man than me, and so there's a certain body language that I can use. But apart from that, there are no externals at all to when I make the move between the two characters.
And why did you write yourself in as a character?
Because it's a very personal statement. At the core of the play is a very personal statement. There, I certain things that I say towards the end of the play about the complexity of confronting change, anxieties about it.
May I quote that?
Yes, by all means.
You say, "You see, the truth is that I am not as brave about change as I would like to be. It involves letting go of things, and I've discovered that it's a lot harder than I thought it was. And then on top of all that, I'm also jealous." Why? What is he jealous of? Or what are you jealous of?
Well, she asks him. She, in fact, goes on after that quote. She goes on to say, "Jealous of what?" And the author answers, Ethel Fugard answers, "Of you, your youth, your dreams. The future belongs to you now. But there was a time when it was mine, when I dreamt about it the way you do. Not anymore. I've just about used up all of the glorious future I once had. But it isn't something you let go of easily. I'm still trying to hold on to it, the way your grandfather wanted to hold on to you." End quote.
So is that how you're feeling now? That
well, I you know, when you're 63 years old, you've got to face the fact that you've got more than half your life behind you, and certainly more than half my writing life. I've got about 40 years of playwriting behind me as I sit talking to you here, Terry, and there aren't that many years left ahead of me. I mean, I suppose with some confidence, I could imagine myself still pushing my pen for another 10 years. But I mean, it's a limited time. I'm very conscious. I'm conscious of limits to time, of limits to energy, and I'm very conscious that of a world that made me passing, and a new world coming into being. I mean, I'm incredibly excited in that. On another level, I've been very rejuvenated by the arrival of a new South Africa, extraordinarily so. It has swept into my life, both as man and writer, with a thrilling sense of challenge. But as I say, a world that made me and in which I expended most of my energies as man and writer, is passing or has just about passed.
I'm interested in how your life as a playwright and actor and, you know, director has changed in the new South Africa. I mean, for you, theater was in part an act of dissidence. You organized theater groups that were interracial at a time when that was virtually illegal.
Correct, yes.
In your country. What's your theater company like now?
Well, this play was, again, like all of my work for the past two decades, was premiered at the Market Theatre in Johannesburg, that wonderful theatre that represented alternative theatre in South Africa at a time when everything else was a form of white self-indulgence. The Market Theatre and its open defiance of government edict in terms of separating the races in the audience and on the stage just ignored all of that. I often think of the Market Theatre in a sense as a test tube of the new South Africa. I think that is where actually we tried out a lot of things for the first time, and I think where the emotional philosophy of the new South Africa was formulated. Valley Song, my new play, was back on that stage. And to the extent that the Market Theatre, since its inception, had had its doors and its stage open to everybody, regardless of skin colour, there was no ostensible physical difference with Valley Song this time around. I mean, I was again able to go up onto that stage with an actor of a different skin colour, and our audience was gloriously mixed. So that aspect of my reality hadn't changed. But there can be no denying the fact that the feeling in the auditorium, that the sense that one got of that audience was of a completely different order now.
What's different?
I believe there's a greater buoyancy in the country. I mean, I know there's still a lot of the pools of anxiety, but I find that the majority of South Africans that I encounter have risen to the challenge. I think that as South Africans, we had arrived at a point where we recognized on both sides of the divide, black and white, that there was no going it alone. There was just no going it alone. There was mutual recognition of need, that we needed each other. And I think because that need was there as a foundation, when we finally had everything in place and when Nelson Mandela was finally inaugurated as president and he had put together a cabinet of national unity, South Africans actually heaved a huge sigh of relief and said, let's get on with it now. Let's get on with it. Which isn't to say that there aren't still very, very critical tensions within our society and that things couldn't be derailed at point in the future. But at this moment in time, people are really trying to make it work. And that sense of a fighting optimism is something that I feel as I was working in theatre.
During the years of apartheid, your plays had a potent symbolic value, not only because of what you were saying in the plays, but because to perform the plays, black people and white people were coming together, often before, I believe, a mixed audience at the Market Theater. This was a powerful thing to happen during apartheid. Now that some of that symbolic value doesn't exist because apartheid is over, do you feel ever that the plays don't have the power that they did, or that, you know, theater doesn't have the symbolic value in South African culture that it did before?
Well, I think we're up against this. You've actually formulated the challenge. You've put your finger on the challenge. Theater practitioners like myself, theater artists like myself, who write plays or produce plays or act in them, we've got to, the challenge we face quite simply is whether, and there is a real need for theatre to be a potent force in the nation building that must take place, on a par with the potent force it was as a platform for dissidents in the old South Africa. That is the challenge we face. Can we make theatre as powerful and as meaningful in the new South Africa as it was in the old, because there is a need for it to be that? Or are we just going to allow it to become almost in a sense what theatre is in so many countries in the West, something which entertains an elitist sector of the society that isn't really rooted in and dealing with the vital life and death issues of that society, and no society on the face of this earth, be it America, England, Scandinavian countries, is without a life and death struggle at its core, at its heart. It's as simple as that. I mean, that is, I believe, an essential reality. And a lot of theatre in this country, let's face it, is not connected to, not dealing with the issues that really confront America at this point in time. And that is our challenge in South Africa. Can we find a way of contributing in the very first instance to the nation building that must take place? Is there a role in terms of vigilance that we must continue to practice?
My guest is South African playwright Ethel Fugard, and his new play, Valley Song, premieres in America October 27th at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey. Let's take a short break, and
certainly,
then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. back with South African playwright Ethel Fugard, who's here for the premiere of his new play, Valley Song, which he not only wrote but also stars in, not just in one role, but in two. We spoke in 1986 when you were in Philadelphia for a production of Master Harold and the Boys. And at the end of the interview, we were talking a little bit about what you saw when you looked ahead into the future of South Africa and what some of your fears were. And I'd like to play just a short excerpt of that interview. So this was recorded in 1986 with Ethel Fugard. How much more violent do you think it's going to get in South Africa?
I think it's going to get a lot worse. I think we've just seen the start of the trouble.
Are there any white liberals who fear change in a way because the distinction might not be made between whites who have opposed the system and whites who have supported it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, you'd be guilty of the most incredible, naive thought process if you're going to live in that country as a liberal and think that an exception is going to be made by the black mob when they happen to come along and find you in their way. There is no way that the violence we are heading for in South Africa now is going to allow for the distinction between a good white and a bad white. You're going to get it like everybody else.
Is there a time that you have in your mind when you think you would actually leave South Africa, if things reached a certain point?
I would never leave South Africa. I'd like to believe I would never leave South Africa. But in making that decision, I mean, I sort of commit my wife to it as well. I haven't quite resolved that one for myself yet.
It sounds to me, listening back to that, that you had just steeled yourself for something that thankfully never happened.
You know, though, I couldn't help thinking that even as I listened to that extract, I couldn't help thinking of the tragic end of that young American student, Amy Beale, in Cape Town. Do you remember the case a few years ago?
Was she the white American
who was killed in one of the townships? Yeah, who met the mob. You know, and she had been working, doing incredibly good mm-hmm. work in that. I couldn't help thinking of her. But anyway, yes, you're right. It does sound as if I'd steeled myself for some terrible times. And I think terrible times did go on to happen in the latter part of the 80s. There was an awful amount of bloodletting in South Africa, which I think also actually started to put the writing on the wall for the country.
That there had to be a change.
There had to be a change.
There was no hope for anybody if there wasn't.
We were heading for major disaster.
Were you ever in that position that you expressed your fear of facing a mob?
No. I've been more frightened, interestingly enough, of white policemen in South Africa. I faced white policemen with real fear and trembling, never a black mob.
You're very glad now that you remained in South Africa. I mean, you've traveled around the world. You've spent a lot of time in America, but you've remained a resident of South Africa. You've never lived in exile, voluntary or otherwise.
Yes, it is. Obviously, I'm very, very happy that I found the sort of strength. And my wife was a major factor in helping me find that strength to stay on in that society. And now to realize that I actually travel abroad with pride as a South African, with pride.
That's something new.
Oh, that's an extraordinary experience. To hand your passport over to an immigration official and to suddenly feel yourself an inch taller because he's going to see you're a South African. I never thought I'd live with that.
So you're preparing for the American premiere of your first play since the end of apartheid. You're starring in the play as well. What's going through your mind now as you prepare for it? I'm sure as an actor and playwright, you're thinking about reviews and what the audience reaction will be like.
Oh, yes. I'm what I'm most concerned with at this point in time is just that first MacArthur audience, which is coming my way in about 2 weeks' time, and informed by with a inevitable degree of anxiety, because although I have behind me the very supportive experience of a successful South African premiere and a successful South African production, I was in front of my own people. And, you know, it was a story made for them. What I'm up against, once again, is whether I've got a story that will live outside and be of significance outside my country. And there's no way that I can predict that before the event. I have to wait and see what exactly my fate is going to be when we reach the last line in front of that first audience.
I have one last question. Have you thought about writing a book, a memoir, that would document what your life in theater under apartheid was like? So people will remember what happened during that period and the people who tried to defy it.
I have a growing sense of responsibility to do that, Terry, because, I mean, it's an important story. I'm not talking about my personal story being important, but just the story of making theater in a situation like that,
mm-hmm.
of being witness to a silenced people discovering a voice in theater and the social consequences, the moral responsibility that engendered and laid on me for the rest of my life. I'm very conscious that those are things that actually should be documented, and so I'm thinking seriously about it.
Good. Ethel Fugard, thank you very much for talking with us.
Wonderful talking to you again, Terry.
Ethel Fugard, his first post-apartheid play, Valley Song, will have its American premiere October 27th at the MacArthur Theater in Princeton. Fugard stars in the production. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a sober comic. Political and social comic Jimmy Tingle tells us how his act changed after he gave up drinking. He's performing a one-man show about it. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the season openers of Prime Suspect and Homicide.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Comic Jimmy Tingle left the club scene for the stage, where he has more freedom to do his kind of material. His one-man show is being held over in Boston at the Hasty Pudding Theater. Those of us outside of Boston will soon be able to hear it on a CD called Jimmy Tingle's Uncommon Sense. The show is part social and political satire and part autobiography. It's also about his style of comedy.
My name is Jimmy Tingle, and that is my real name. And I'm from Cambridge, Massachusetts, originally. And I hope everybody here enjoys the discussion of politics, society, and life in general as seen through the stained glass windows of my soul. Because quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, I have very few jokes.
Jimmy Tingle, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Jimmy, how would you describe your show and how it compares to, say, just doing stand-up?
Well, the show is, it's been a work in progress for about 5 years, and it's basically social and political humor with an autobiographical through line. It's not just about the political and social issues at hand in the world, but it's also my reaction to them and how those issues affect me.
Now, have you done this in comedy clubs or mostly in more theatrical kind of settings?
I started out in comedy clubs. I tried to do it in comedy clubs, but certain material just was not appropriate for comedy clubs. There's a piece in the show about drinking, about beer drinking, and, you know, and how it starts off very glorious and a lot of fun, and then it can turn ugly with some people, as it did with me. But anyway, when I would do that in the clubs, you know, the waitresses would be, the cash register wasn't ringing, they weren't selling any drinks, the club owners pacing back and forth. And so they said, Jim, you know, we really think the piece is great for theater, but could you take it out of the show for the comedy club? We're losing money. So not all of the material was really appropriate for comedy clubs.
Did you take it out?
They gave me a comedy club fee, and I did take it out for that week. And I aspire to go to theaters. They paid me to take it out, is what I'm saying.
Wow. Yeah,
Jim, we'll give you more money if you take out the piece.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good way to make a living. Here's some jokes.
Yeah.
Okay, I won't tell them. Now you can pay me. Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we hear an excerpt of your show that has to do with drinking? And
sure.
Since we're not serving drinks to our audience, I think this will be okay.
No matter who you are in the making of beer, no matter how you feel in the making of beer, drinking when you're seasick, drinking when you can't sleep, you know that feeling? You know that feeling? Some of you know that feeling. Stomach growling, head is spinning, hands are shaking, body sweating through the sheets. You're way too paranoid to sleep. Get out of bed and find an occasion to drink the beer. Birthdays, weddings, wakes, funerals, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Bar mitzvah, bowling, a confirmation, a dedication, season's greetings, divorce hearings. We won the game. We lost the game. The game got rained out. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, New Year's Eve, Monday morning, after court, before drunk driving school. You can have a beer.
It's Jimmy Tingle from his one-man show and his forthcoming CD. Jimmy, when did you stop drinking?
Let's see, 88, in September of 88.
So you were already performing when you stopped drinking?
Yeah. Yeah, I had been doing comedy about 7 years. And, you know, in the beginning, of course, it was fine. But, I mean, drinking with me was a thing we picked up as a teenager. And it was just kind of became a way of life and became a habit that was just kind of a way of life. And so when I started doing comedy, it just fit right in with the whole scene. And in the beginning, it's, you know, it works for you in a way, but after a while, it started to work against me. It's very difficult to write new material when you're asleep. It's very difficult to want to get up.
Right.
And, you know, and want to get up and, you know, look at the day and attack the day and have your mind clear and fresh and clean and, you know, to write, to create, to just show up on time at the show. Little things that are kind of important. And so all those reasons, plus just the overall feeling of my personal life, was just, it just took a big toll on me. And
I just wanted to get rid of it, you know. I just tried to get away from it, basically.
Would you usually have a drink with you on stage when you were performing?
Yeah, yeah. But see, the thing is, and I used to think it was just because, well, you know, I read an article with George Carlin once, and they asked him, George, do you smoke pot on the day of the show to get up for the show? And his answer was, you know, he smoked pot when he got up or something. Or he, you know, when he during that day, and then that show was something he had to do that night. And that's how I felt, you know. It was just like a way of life, and I'd be drinking whether I was working or not. So, yes, to answer the question, yeah, there was always beer or alcohol around, and I usually had it on stage. Sure, it becomes a part of your persona and your whole, you know, your MO, so to speak.
How have your performances changed since giving up drinking?
Well, one thing it does to you is it stuns your emotional growth, and it took an effect on me. I mean, for instance, you kind of were trapped in a mindset of where you started drinking. So I guess, you know, I was maybe 30 years old, but in the mind of an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old to a certain extent. So, I mean, a lot of my humor was maybe a little bluer when I was, you know, was drinking. It was more reactionary. I mean, I would make fun of things that when I quit drinking, I kind of started taking up. Like, for instance, I'd always, you know, make fun of people who were working out or jogging, you know. A lot of my material had to do with drinking, you know. I mean, like, I read an article in the newspaper that said beer was actually considered a food. I was psyched. Well, for years, people thought I was an alcoholic. Calm down. I'm hungry.
Yeah.
And to audiences who are drinking and having a good time, they love it, right? But then when you stop drinking, it's kind of like you're not being true to yourself. So the material kind of started to change. And I just started reading a lot more. And I started to rely on other stimulus to kind of inspire that creativity.
Do you mean like coffee or ideas?
No. I mean like newspapers and radio and news programs, and just started paying more attention to the world and the political climate, and started relying on things that, I mean, I had gone to college and I'd studied, you know, some history and political science and sociology, and that stuff always interested me. So I started to kind of just change in what I felt to be important, because when I was drinking heavily, everything was about drinking and partying and putting down people who went to health food stores and, you know, health food. And you know, I don't trust a store. As soon as you walk in, a man with the physique of this wire comes up to me to tell me that the vegetables look healthy. Yeah, the vegetables look fine. You are in serious trouble. Somebody turns on the fan, you're in orbit. And people are walking around with T-shirts that say, go hike the canyon. Why don't you go home and smoke in bed, will you please? But anyway, my material started to change from attacking health food stores and people who work out and jog and are actually trying to live a better life to kind of some of the political climate, some of the political things that were happening in the world. Like, you know, like when we invaded Grenada, I'm saying, Grenada, what courage. What are you going to take next, Martha's Vineyard? And it started to talk about issues more, as shall we say, grown-up or adult themes.
Well, why don't we pause here, and I'll play something from your forthcoming CD, which is a recording of your one-man show. And this will show a little bit more of your political humor.
I mean, let's face it, folks, with the end of the Cold War, it's no longer a struggle between democracy and communism. Right now, the whole thing is expanding economics. In the old days, the United States would go into a third world country, set up a dictator just to keep those people free. Now, now we don't even refer to it as the third world anymore, folks. It's not the third world. No, no, no. It's the emerging markets. They're the emerging markets. We're the merging markets. ABC merges with Disney, CBS merges with Westinghouse. Eventually, folks, there's going to be one company running the entire country. You don't pay your phone bill, they tow your car. And if we're not buying something, they have a way of making us feel guilty about it. The economy's not doing very well. And basically, the reason is a serious lack of consumer confidence. That's the problem with the American economy, folks. People lack confidence. People don't lack confidence. People lack money. People in this country are not buying lottery tickets to boost their self-esteem.
That's Jimmy Tingle from his forthcoming CD, Jimmy Tingle's Uncommon Sense, live from the Hasty Pudding Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's performing at the Hasty Pudding through November 4th. We'll talk more with Jimmy Tingle after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic Jimmy Tingle. Was there a point where your politics started to really differ from your friends or from your family?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I really didn't get much of my input from them so much as I did from newspapers and articles and journals that I was reading in the company that I was keeping. What I did is I moved from Boston down to New York in 88, and I was there for the next 6 years or so. And so I wasn't really in contact on a day-to-day basis with the how do you think about this, or how do you think about that concerning politics, which took me away from something very valuable, which is just other people that you know and love and their opinions about things. But in another way, it opened me up to more so to the world of just living in another city away from home and more journals and magazines and different types of viewpoints, which was very good. Now I'm living back in Boston. And like, for instance, when I was living in New York, you know, you would see the homeless, but I didn't know any of them. And you would see the police officers, but I didn't know any of them personally. Or you see the firefighters or the postal workers or the teachers, but you didn't know them. Here, I come here, I know the police where I grew up and the fire and the guys in the fire department and, you know, the postal workers. So it's a nice feeling. It has a connection that I didn't have in New York. And even some of the homeless, I see that guy, go, hey, I drank with that guy. It's not necessarily uplifting, but at least it does give you some sort of insight into where these people are coming from. And you see them as human beings rather than, quote, the homeless, quote, the police, quote, the fire department.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you know a pretty diverse group of people, too.
Yes. Yep. Very much so.
What kind of neighborhood did you grow up in?
Working class, middle class neighborhood. A lot of different types of people. Mostly it's an Irish, Italian, Portuguese, Black, Spanish, Greek, Jewish to a certain extent. Some Protestant, very few. But it was a very mixed neighborhood. Went to public schools. Cambridge is a very diverse place. That's where I grew up. Plus, you had the Harvard and MIT influence, which was just on a different plane altogether. But those people are, you know, mixed. Like, my parents rented rooms. We had Harvard students and MIT students living in our house. My father was in the cab business. He owned his own taxi business. And that was interesting, going every place in a cab growing up. One time he took us hunting in a cab.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love that idea.
We pull up to the forest, you know, in a big yellow cab. Animals immediately start goofing on us, you know. Bears are looking out of the forest. Somebody call a cab.
Now, what's the experience been like for you of taking parts of your life and working it into a performance? I mean, it seems to me it gives a great opportunity to kind of take the chaos of your life and shape it and make it into this coherent story. Actually, a humorous, coherent story.
Mm-hmm.
Has it given you a different take on your life?
Well, you know, most of the stuff I talk about is not particularly positive stuff. I mean, you know, there's nothing really... I mean, they're kind of negative things. I mean, drinking too much is on it... On the face value, it was not a positive thing. But on the flip side of that, what I've gotten in return, it's increased my spiritual life tremendously. It's just given me a clearer head and a direction in life and something I never want to go back to. So it's kind of like a victory of overcoming something that was on the surface a giant negative. So it's kind of a journey, but it's a lot of struggle and just trying to keep going with things like the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings. I mean, you know, when those hearings became public, I was sitting there watching them with the woman I had just started going out with, and I'm watching it, and I'm embarrassed because as they're asking Clarence Thomas questions, you know, "Mr. Thomas, did you say pubic hair on the Coke can?" And I'm sitting there going, "Pubic hair on the Coke can? I've said a hell of a lot worse than that. I mean, if I ever went out drinking and said, like, pubic hair on the Coke can, that would be a really good night." The same thing with the homophobia growing up. I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't know any gays, or I didn't know anybody that I knew was gay, put it that way. I was petrified of gays, you know? And as I got older and I got to know and become friends with a few gay folks, you know, it became okay. So the homophobia evaporates. Well, it's all a growth pattern and an evolution, a personal journey myself. And I think people identify with that because most people grow up with certain fears, prejudices, narrow thinking. None of us grow up knowing everything, and none of us are ever going to know everything. So it's just a process.
What's it like for you to almost become a character in your own performance? Because I think with the kind of material you're doing, you do become something of a character.
I don't see it that way, but there's a certain detachment, I suppose. I don't detach very well from it, though, I gotta tell you. I mean, when I relive a lot of it on stage, and that adds to the emotional toll that it takes on me. I was saying this to one of the gentlemen at the theater. He says, "But Jimmy, now you're an actor. You don't have to get emotionally involved." And I said, "I don't know if I am an actor. I mean, I am acting, and I am putting emphasis in certain places, and I am, you know, using inflections to make points and my voice and all this sort of stuff and facial expressions, but the material is very, very close to me personally. So, it allows me probably to be more truthful because I don't allow myself to get away with stuff that isn't true. And even if it's not what you would want, I would want them to think of me. You know, in the course of the show, I show things that are not flattering about myself. And that's just the way it is. But it's the truth. And there is no right or wrong if it's the truth. So, that is kind of difficult. But it's also rewarding because people identify with it.
Hey, in the spirit of fresh air, tell us something unflattering that you discuss on the show.
Well, I mean, just the embarrassedness, like, for instance, you know, growing up homophobic or growing up with, you know, attitudes like the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, and the drinking stuff. I mean, how much stuff do I have to tell? Jeez. Come on, Terry, you're drawing it out of me. What are we, in confession? I'm going back. I'm Father Gross. Excuse me, Mother Gross. Bless me, Mother, if I have sinned.
And we will make it public.
Years. Yeah.
Yes, you have sinned, and we will broadcast it.
Right.
Well, Jimmy Tingle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Terry. It's been a blast.
Jimmy Tingle performs his one-man show at the Hasty Pudding Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts, through November 4th. His CD of the show, Jimmy Tingle's Uncommon Sense, will be released next month on the label Lyric Moon. Here's more from the show.
We hear an awful lot about welfare reform. We don't hear anything about wage reform. Everybody wants the people on welfare to work. I say, fine, absolutely. I got a couple of questions. Number one, where? And number two, how much are they going to pay these people? I mean, you could work for the minimum wage in this country, 40 hours a week, and at the end of the month, after taxes, bring home $500. Now, the average cost of an apartment is $600. So you haven't even moved in yet. You're already $100 in debt. But just suppose, folks, you found a place for $400 a month. that will leave you $100 for the rest of the month for food, clothing, and utilities. $100 divided by 30 days comes out to $3.33 a day. I think I'll write a book, America, on $3.33 a day. It'll be very big in Europe. And what does one do with $3.33 a day? Well, you take $1 and open an IRA. You take $2 and put it in a savings account. At 2.5% interest, 3.2% inflation, at the end of the month, you got $1.75.
This is Fresh Air. Two police dramas are about to return to television. Homicide: Life on the Street starts a new season Friday night on NBC. Prime Suspect begins its fourth installment Sunday night on PBS. TV critic David Bianculli has this preview.
Let's start with Prime Suspect. Helen Mirren is back as Detective Jane Tennyson, and as long as she's playing the role, Prime Suspect is automatically worth watching. Her character is so complex and her acting is so good that there's no way to turn away. In each installment of Prime Suspect, Jane Tennyson has gained a little more power. This time out, she's risen to the rank of detective superintendent. But each time, she's up against sexism at the office while trying to solve murders on the streets. She always makes some new allies, but she also makes some new enemies. As in this scene, when she finds and confronts a Mark Furman-type cop who may have just botched her big case.
I've been paging you all over the station for the past hour.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear.
Oh, no, no. That's not good enough, Inspector.
Well, I'm sorry, Mom! All right?
The mystery this time is about a murdered child. But the mystery this time isn't seen on Mystery. It's shown instead on Masterpiece Theater, and as a one-shot telemovie, not a four-part miniseries. The move from one PBS series to another doesn't matter at all, but the reduction in length does. There's less room for character development here, and this new Prime Suspect suffers as a result. But it's still very good. Homicide, which returns Friday night on NBC, is even better. Forget all this talk about NYPD Blue. Homicide: Life on the Street is the best drama series on TV right now. And Andre Brower, as Detective Frank Pemberton, is TV's best actor, period. The season opener for Homicide is a two-parter, which means it actually takes up more screen time than the new Prime Suspect. The time is used well. A new character is introduced, two characters leave, the ones played by Ned Beatty and Daniel Baldwin, and an impressively complicated mystery is laid out. There's a warehouse fire with a kid found dead inside, then there's another fire and another young victim. Arson Detective Mike Kellerman, played by Reed Diamond, is brought aboard and immediately clashes with Pemberton. Kyle Secor as Pemberton's partner Bayless and Yaphet Kotto as their boss Giardello are also on hand, trying to make sense of the evidence while Kellerman and Pemberton go at it.
There's someone going around town burning teenagers to death in warehouses?
It would appear so, sir.
Kellerman, you still believe the guy to be a professional?
Professional arsonists don't kill, not on purpose.
So, just who are we looking for, Kellerman?
Maybe someone obsessed with fire? The image of fire, the idea of fire? Someone maybe with firefighting in his background? A father, an uncle?
Whoa, hang on. Let's just stick to the facts here. Someone killed Mark Landry, someone killed this girl. But Landry was killed by a fire, and this girl was killed first and then dumped in the fire. Why this difference?
There is a possibility the two fires are unrelated.
So what? The way in which they were set is a coincidence?
Yes.
Yeah, Bayless.
Well, I tend not to believe in coincidences.
I don't believe in coincidences either. so there's probably something to the fact that one of the subplots in Homicide has to do with a female cop getting promoted. The writers of Homicide are aware of Prime Suspect 2 and know a good thing when they see one. So do I. And both these shows are good things.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Well, speaking of crime, tomorrow our film critic Stephen Schiff will review the new movie Get Shorty, based on the Elmore Leonard novel. John Travolta stars as a loan shark who goes to L.A. on business, finds he feels right at home in Hollywood, and decides what he really wants to do is produce movies. John Lurie wrote the music for the film. Let's hear music from the new soundtrack recording. Music from the film Get Shorty. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Alan Tu, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Updike and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Plume Paperbacks, publisher of Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas, with a new introduction by authors Jane Mayer and Jill Abramson. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.